Oh boy, here we go. We are ready to embark upon an adventure. This is an exciting adventure. It's a scary adventure. It's a thrilling and the, okay, we're going to look at stocks. And we're going to spend quite a bit of time on stocks, folks, because that's where the action is. In fact, in Spanish, that's what they're called, acciones, actions. And we start with a quote from a famous humorist of the early 20th century. Don't gamble. Take all your savings and buy some good stock and hold it till it goes up. And if it don't go up, don't buy it. Yeah, very wise advice. Well, at the time, this was very prescient because an entire generation, two generations of people were turned off, were turned off by the thought of buying stocks because of the 1920s run-up and then subsequent crash and then the Great Depression. So it wasn't until the 1950s and 60s that people started thinking of stocks as something other than gambling. Right. We've had our similar, but it hasn't even been 10 years yet. We've had a similar debacle in 2008 and 2009, and people are just starting to feel comfortable about stocks now, but it'll be quite a bit more time also, I think. So let's take a look at slide number two. What are stocks? Well, this is a bit of review because we said in chapter one, when we did our overview, that stocks represent ownership in a corporation. Stocks are equity financing, and that's the term that accountants use for ownership. So when someone says equities, they mean stocks. And by the way, the real term is common stocks. But very few people actually use that term. And where did it come from? Well, it came from the idea that was started 400 years ago in the United Kingdom and the Netherlands when these corporations were set up from the idea that the shareholders were shareholders in common. Every share got one vote. The more shares you had, the more influence you had over the corporation. They enable investors to participate in the profit and growth generated by the business enterprise. But unlike a sole proprietorship, stockholders are limited liability owners. You can only lose your investment. And if you've taken Business 120, you discuss this at length. And if you take Business 120, you'll discuss it when you get to Business 120, Introduction to Business. Partnerships, sole proprietorships, you and the business are one and the same. So that if the business racks up all kinds of debts, they can come after you. But a corporation is an entity unto itself, and the shareholders are limited liability owners, meaning that if the corporation racks up all kinds of debts above and beyond what the corporation has as assets, they can't come after the shareholders. Once you've lost your $100 or whatever you put in, $1,000, that's it. Now, when you take business law, take the introduction to business, you'll read and hear about times when the courts can pierce the corporate veil. Some people, unscrupulous, will set up corporations just to try to hide liability, and the courts can pierce the corporate veil. But the companies we're discussing here in this class, that's not an issue. Why would you own stock? Well, we said back in Chapter 1 that stockholders, shareholders, receive optional payments of earnings called dividends. And if the business grows and prospers, then the stock should go up. Capital gains, capital appreciation. And of course, if the company doesn't do well, indeed, we will have capital losses. Contrary to what many people believe and how many people behave, stocks are not simply pieces of paper that are trade each day for no reason. Well, they're not even pieces of paper anymore. It's all electronic, right? No, they represent ownership in real businesses. So when you see that FedEx or UPS truck driving down the road and you're a shareholder in either, you say, hey, you know, that's my company. When you go to the mall and you see JCPenney's, you say, okay, I own some of that, or Walmart. Or if you buy Nike shoes and you own Nike stock, you are part owner of that company. Now, unless you own a whole bunch of shares, you're a bitty, bitty owner. You can go up to that truck and point to the lug nut on the left front tire and say, there's my part of FedEx. But these corporations are very large. So, we join in the success of that corporation, or lack thereof. Slide number 3. Let's take a look at the historical performance. And over the long-term history of modern finance, and what are we talking about? 1910, 1920s, and there's some historical reasons for that, which we won't go into. But we often measure from the 1910s, 1920s. The return from the stock market has averaged around 10, 11%. But in any one year, it is unlikely that the return will be 10 or 11%. The return has varied from a high of almost 54% to a low of minus 43.5%. In 2008, yeah, that was a rough year. Minus 38.5%, one of the worst. And in any given year, there's about a 1 in 3 or 1 in 4 chance that the market will go down. Now, is it lockstep? 1, 2, 3, down, 1, 2, 3, up, down, 1, down? No, it doesn't work that way. In fact, from 1982 to 2000, the market went in two directions, up and way up. And everybody thought, oh, well, it's blue skies, productivity gains, the internet, new technology. The market will never go down. It went down 3 years in a row, 2000, 2001, and 2002. And just when everybody thought it would never go back up again, it turned around in 2003. And yeah, exactly. That's what you do, folks, when you invest in stocks. You just ride the roller coaster. Slide number 4. This is the graph from chapter 1 that we already took a look at. And again, I want you to ignore small company stocks because there's what we call survivorship bias there. But I'm not trying to say small company stocks have not done better than large company stocks. They have. It's just a lot more volatile, and there's a whole lot more chance for things to go really wrong. But notice, when we take a look at large company stocks versus bonds, we find that the stocks have just trounced bonds. And should we even mention short-term securities, savings accounts, treasury bills? They've kept up with inflation, but just barely. If we want long-term compounded growth, where do we go? We go to the stock market. And notice, you might have noticed if you're a math major, what's going on with this scale? This is called a logarithmic scale, where every increment is not a factor of 1, it's a factor of 10. If this were arithmetic, exactly. We wouldn't even notice any change for treasury bills or long-term bonds. We would see an exponential graph. And that's what logarithmic scales do. They turn an exponential graph into a straight line or all in it. I know, even still, I mean, it still looks pretty squiggly, doesn't it, as it go along. And those squiggles represent some big jumps. And I think I've mentioned this before. One person likened the stock market to somebody walking up a flight of stairs with a yo-yo. And the market is the yo-yo. But the flight of stairs is the global economy. And as the global economy continues to expand, and more, hundreds of millions currently, of people leave poverty and enter the middle class and have the same things that we've taken for granted for 100 years. Clean water, good food, shelter, clothing, toothpaste, soap. The companies that supply these products should prosper. But there are no guarantees. I think you've heard me say that before. Slide number 5. Here is a very telling graph. Because what it does is it turns the annual returns into 10-year periods. And what we see are some very interesting patterns here. If we go back to the Great Depression, we see that there were rolling 10-year periods where our return from the stock market was negative. They don't call it the Great Depression for nothing, folks. 25% of people were unemployed at one time at the depth of the Great Recession. And here we are coming out of the recession, out of World War II, in the go-go 50s and 60s, and the stock market went in two directions, up and way up. And sure enough, finally people decided that stocks weren't such a bad idea after 40 years of people hating them, two whole generations, just in time for the 1970s. What happened in the 1970s? Well, first, stocks were fairly valued, richly valued. And we had the baby boom generation coming of age. That was the big economic issue of the time. I mean, there were lots of other things going on. Vietnam, Watergate, the oil crises, disco. Yeah. But the 1970s were a very difficult year for stocks. And what we see is that the stock market just barely returned a positive return over 10 years. Didn't go negative, but still, very discouraging. And then, coming out of the 1970s, we see the technology and the globalization, right? Countries realizing that capitalism may be the worst system out there, but it's better than all the others. And the Cold War ending, it was a very heady time. People started to realize that, yes, this is not perfect, capitalism, but it sure is better than everything else out there. And we see that great run-up between 1982 and 2000, where the market goes up in two directions, up and way up, and blue skies, productivity gains, the internet, we're all going to be rich, 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 and we get hit by the tech crash, where companies lost 90-some percent of their value or just disappeared entirely. And then the housing bubble. We went from one bubble, the tech bubble, to the housing bubble. And you have to go back to the Great Depression to find rolling 10-year periods where the stock market was negative. But that's what happened to us in the 2000s. Some people call it the lost decade. But here we go. The last few years, what's happening? Now, does this guarantee that the same kind of hyperkinetic market is going to befall us again? Are people going to lose track of their senses and bid up prices to outrageous amounts? Well, some might say that it's already happening. And they are right with a few companies that have huge valuations, the social media companies these days. But for the most part, when I take a look, that doesn't mean I'm right, folks. When I look at the market, I think it's fairly valued, a little bit on the rich side, not overly. Does that mean it's not going to fall? Of course it's going to fall. We know it's going to fall. We know. History tells us there are going to be years that are negative. But we need to think of that as an opportunity. Because when the market falls, that gives us a chance to buy more. Remember, dollar cost average? Exactly. But I'm very optimistic. As I've already said, the next 10 to 20 years, providing we don't blow ourselves up or a meteorite or a tsunami or disco returns or whatever, the next 20, 30 years should be the most prosperous years in the history of the world. Come back in 20 years if I'm still alive, and you'll see if I'm right or not. Slide number 6. Traditionally, close to half of the return from stocks was from reinvested dividends. Dividends don't lie, because that's money in your pocket. Stockholders used to expect 4 to 5 to 6% in dividends each year. That was as much or oftentimes more than what bonds were returning in interest payments, since stocks were considered much more riskier than bonds. From 1936 to 2008, the average dividend, the dividend average on the S&P, the Standard & Poor's 500, which we will discuss in subsequent presentations in more detail, we've already touched on it, 500 largest companies in the United States, was 3.8%, almost 4%. But in the 1980s, the 1990s, dividends fell as a percentage. Why? Because prices kept going up. So as a percentage, the dividends fell to less than 2% or even 0%. Many companies just didn't pay dividends. Capital gains, growth, were what people wanted in the 1990s. And the Standard & Poor's 500 dividend average from 1997 to 2007 was 1.5%. At the peak of the tech bubble in March of 2000, the Standard & Poor's dividend hit 1%, went down to 1%. Now, there were various reasons that were given for this. Dividends were taxed at a higher rate than capital gains, so don't give me dividends, give me capital gains, I don't want to pay taxes. People wanted the business to reinvest earnings for growth instead of distributing it to the investors. Don't pay me any dividends, I want you to turn around and invest it back in the company. Well, sometimes that doesn't work out so well when companies buy other companies thinking that there's going to be what they call synergy. The biggest thing, that's when I knew, I said, this is not going to last. When AOL, America Online, you ever hear of them? Yeah. When they bought Time Warner back in 2000 or late 1999, I forget exactly when it was. But that was it. When you knew, Time Warner. I mean, this company's been around for decades and AOL has been around for 8 years. That's when you knew that this bubble wasn't going to last. Stocks were no longer considered riskier than bonds. Well, some people don't really understand risk. And no, stocks are much more riskier than bonds, folks. But over the long term, right, exactly. Savings accounts were also paying less than 2%. Well, that was true. And now they're paying less than 0.2%. And people lost track of their senses and bid up the prices. It was a new era. It's different this time. And all of these were true to some extent. So there was a confluence, an amalgamation. Like those words, they make me sound like I'm very smart, don't they? You know, all these things came together to make for a very high market and that everyone thought would never go down. And since then, now everybody, exactly, everybody knows that, yes, markets go down, yes. Here is the yield on bonds versus the yield on stocks. And what we find is back in 1960, bonds paid more than stocks, not much more. But then what happened in the 1970s? Again, the baby boom generation coming of age. And everybody's got to go out and find a job. And everybody's got to buy a house and cars and washing machines and shoes. And inflation took hold. Well, to a bond investor, inflation is their worst nightmare. Apart from the company going into default. But in terms of overall portfolio of bonds, inflation is very dangerous to a bondholder. So bond investors started to demand higher and higher interest rates. And as the stock market fell, the dividend rate overall went up as a percentage of the prices that you paid for those stocks. And we see the peak around 1980, 1981, when the Federal Reserve Bank, under the direction of Paul Volcker, jacked up short-term interest rates to break the back of inflation. And it's an interesting story. In the late 70s, then-President Jimmy Carter, yes, we did have a president by the name of Jimmy, went to Paul Volcker and said, we got to do something about inflation. What can you do? And he said, well, Mr. President, we can do something. If you appoint me as the Federal Reserve Chair, I will take care of inflation, but it might cost you your presidency. And to Mr. Carter's credit, he said, do what's right for the country. And sure enough, that wasn't the only thing. The Iran hostage crisis really made him look bad. And sure enough, Paul Volcker and the Federal Reserve Bank jacked up interest rates to the point where it caused a severe recession, but it broke the back of inflation. And what do we see? We see interest rates starting to fall precipitously. Next Federal Reserve Chairman, Alan Greenspan, called it the Great Moderation. And as the price of stocks went up, we see the yield on dividends starting to fall because the price keeps going up. And there you see, as I said, March of 2000, the dividend rate hit 1% on the S&P. And what's happened since then? Well, interest rates have continued to fall. And here's 2008. Ouch. People flocked. This is the 10-year Treasury bond, by the way. Treasury. United States Treasury. People flocked to Treasuries and dumped stocks, and we see the yield on stocks go above the yield on 10-year Treasury bonds. Well, that was a screaming buy signal for those people who believe in, charting and the like. Well, what happened is prices had just fallen so far. And that was, of course, in hindsight, a great time to buy. And then we see it happen again in 2012. And again, that was a screaming good time to buy because stocks did almost 30% in 2013. And what's happening now? Well, they're very close. But this is at the end of the year, and it turns out, dear students, that since the beginning of 2015, the yield on 10-year treasuries has fallen yet again to the point where it is below what the Standard & Poor's 500 is yielding in terms of dividends. So history tells us that this is a great time to buy stocks, because whenever the yield on the 10-year treasury goes below the yield on the S&P 500, that has historically been a good time to buy stocks. But you know what I'm going to say, right? There are no guarantees. It doesn't mean it's going to happen. And we have to deal with the volatility. Personally, I think we're due. We are due for a, what we call a correction, long overdue. History tells us we're long overdue. But that doesn't mean it's going to happen this year or next year. As the great run-up between 1982 and 2000 told us, it might have happened for a few more years. But it's going to happen. Slide number 8. The pendulum swings. The bear markets of 2000 to 2002 and 2008 have changed investors' perception about dividends. We now see more and more investors and companies focusing more and more attention on dividends. Many companies that never paid dividends in the past are doing so now. And the greatest example of this are the tech companies that are no longer growth stocks, folks. They are mature industries. For example, Microsoft and Intel and Apple and Google. They have cash coming out of their ears and they're afraid to pay dividends because that would tell the world that they believe they're a mature industry. Well, finally, I think they were sitting on 60-some billion dollars. This was 2003. And Microsoft, how many times can they rewrite Windows? Every time they do it, they make it worse. And Office, in my humble opinion, but that's my opinion. And so they finally started paying dividends. And the same thing is true now of Apple and Google. They're starting to pay dividends because they have cash coming out of their ears. And excuse me, got a bit of a cough, excuse me. The tax law has changed dividends so that they are taxed roughly the same as capital gains. So that argument about dividends being taxed higher and capital gains, it doesn't wash anymore. Now, there's a woman by the name of Geraldine Weiss, and I think she's based in La Jolla. She wrote a book, which is not the best book, but I love the name. In fact, I use it often. Dividends don't lie. Because it's absolutely true. We're gonna take a look at financial statements, cash flow, statement of cash flows, income statement, the balance sheet in subsequent chapters. So we'll get to those. But all those numbers that we see could be all lies. You don't know that they're correct. Sometimes the people putting them together don't know exactly if they're correct. But the one number you know is the truth is the dividend. Because they wrote you a check. Well, now they don't write checks anymore. They electronically send it into your account. But still, they wrote you a check for that amount. So dividends don't lie. And here's a great quote that is attributed to the great John D. Rockefeller. It's attributed to him. His neighbor said that he said it, so we don't know if he actually said it, but it's a great quote. Do you know the only thing that gives me pleasure? It's to see my dividends coming in. I like dividends. Slide number 9. Let's review the pros and the cons of stock ownership. The pros. Well, it allows the general public, you and I, the little people, to share in the rewards of the business enterprise. It's been the best. I should add the word financial. I keep thinking to do that and I keep forgetting. Best financial investment returns over time. I know the real estate investors start jumping up and down and screaming and hollering, yeah, but you're not doing real estate. Dividends and capital gains have returned the best financial investment over time. They are extremely liquid, assuming you deal with real companies. It's very easy to buy and sell. We discussed the limited liability. And one of the things that we don't often talk about, and I think I've mentioned this, is that you're participating in the capital markets, that the ultimate goal, the reason these things exist, is to increase the standard of living for everyone. So it's a noble goal. And in the meantime, we want to get rich doing it, yes, but still, it is Lloyd Blankenship, not Blankfeld. He's the CEO of Goldman Sachs. He said he was doing God's work. They were doing, not he, but the company was doing God's work. Well, that was a poor choice of terms. Blankfeld, right? Blankfield? That was a poor choice of words. He should not have used God's work. This is Caesar, dear students. Render under Caesar that which is Caesar. This is Caesar. But still, it's a noble endeavor. Even with all the hanky-panky and and greed. Now, what are the cons of stock ownership? Well, it's risky, folks. You can lose a lot of money. If the company goes bankrupt, your investment will basically be wiped out normally. And it is volatile. Now, we've already talked quite a bit about volatility and how it's very difficult to measure, and we use standard deviation, which is not a very good measurement, but it is real. And as I remember one student saying, as we were going through the semester and it was a time of increased volatility, she said, the volatility is real. Yeah, it is. We'll take a look at it on the next slide. And of course, the financial industry and the corporate shenanigans, trucos, suave sortas, hanky panky, because that's where the money is. But let's end our introduction to stock by looking at the volatility. This is the Standard & Poor's 500 for year 2014. So, the industry often uses $10,000. I don't know why, but that's what they use. The Securities and Exchange Commission, I guess, said that's what you should use. I don't know that many people have $10,000 lying around the house. But then again, I teach at Southwestern Community College. That's not a knock, folks. That's not a knock. It's just the reality. I'm happy if we can get people to put $50 or $100 a month away. But sure enough, you're convinced. You put $10,000 into the Standard & Poor's 500 on January 1st, 2014, and within about a month, a little over a month, you had lost $500. So you are frightened. You don't want to lose anymore, so you take it out just in time for the market to jump back up to where it was and then some. And then it does it again. So you put it back in towards the end, towards August or so, only to watch it fall again. And then you take it out because you don't want to lose it anymore. And then it jumps back up again. Do you see why the volatility will drive you insane? Because you can't predict it, folks. Don't even try, in my humble opinion. The yo-yo bounces up and down as you're walking up the stairs, and it doesn't happen with any predictability. I'll say this again, and I may have said it already once. There are people who are paid tremendous sums of money to inaccurately predict which way the market's going to go. Exactly. Can you imagine how much they could make if they could accurately predict it? You can't. Don't try. Put your $50, $100 away, or $10,000 if you happen to have it lying around the house, and just let it ride. Assuming you have a long-term perspective. If you have a short-term perspective, do you want it in? Right, we already discussed this, right? You don't. You have to use one of the short-term investments that we discussed in Chapter 1. So, go back over this. Make sure you understand the information that's here. Because in our next presentation, we will describe the markets themselves, where stocks are traded, and see that the world is changing very rapidly for what is often referred to as Wall Street. See you in our next presentation.